perhaps only to see whether here he could sacrifice all or only 2 rubles. And in the monastery he met this elder. I must digress to explain what an elder is in Russian monasteries, and I'm sorry that I do not feel very competent to do so. I will try, however, to give a superficial account of it in a few words. Authorities on the subject assert that the institution of elders is of recent date, not more than 100 years old in our monasteries. Though in the Orthodox East, especially in Sinai and Athos, it has existed over 1,000 years. It is maintained that it existed in ancient times in Russia also, but through the calamities which overtook Russia, the Tatars, civil war, the interruption of relations with the East after the destruction of Constantinople, this institution fell into oblivion. It was revived among us toward the end of the last century by one of the great ascetics, as they called him, Paisy Velichovsky, and his disciples. But to this day it exists in few monasteries only, and has sometimes been almost persecuted as an innovation in Russia. It flourished especially in the celebrated Kozelsky Optin monastery. When and how it was introduced into our monastery, I cannot say. There had already been 3 such elders, and Zosima was the last of them. But he was almost dying of weakness and disease, and they had no one to take his place. The question of our monastery was an important one, for it had not been distinguished by anything in particular till then. They had neither relics of saints, nor wonder-working icons, nor glorious traditions, nor historical exploits. It had flourished and been glorious all over Russia through its elders. To see and hear whom, pilgrims had flocked for thousands of miles from all parts. What was such an elder? An elder was one who took your soul, your will, into his soul and his will. When you choose an elder, you renounce your own will and yield it to him in complete submission, complete self-abnegation. This novitiate, this terrible school of abnegation, is undertaken voluntarily in the hope of self-conquest, of self-mastery, in order, after a life of obedience, to attain perfect freedom, that is, from self, to escape the lot of those who have lived their whole life without finding their true selves in themselves. This institution of elders is not founded on theory, but was established in the East from the practice of 1,000 years. The obligations due to an elder are not the ordinary obedience, which has always existed in our Russian monasteries. The obligation involves confession to the elder by all who have submitted themselves to him, and to the indissoluble bond between him and them. The story is told, for instance, that in the early days of Christianity, one such novice, failing to fulfill some command laid upon him by his elder, left his monastery in Syria and went to Egypt. There, after great exploits, he was found worthy at last to suffer torture and a martyr's death for the faith. When the church, regarding him as a saint, was burying him, suddenly, at the deacon's exhortation, "Depart, all ye unbaptized," the coffin containing the martyr's body left its place and was cast forth from the church, and this took place 3 times. And only at last they learned that this holy man had broken his vow of obedience and left his elder, and therefore could not be forgiven without the elder's absolution, in spite of his great deeds. Only after this could the funeral take place. This, of course, is only an old legend. But here is a recent instance. A monk was suddenly commanded by his elder to quit Athos, which he loved as a sacred place and a haven of refuge, and to go first to Jerusalem to do homage to the holy places, and then to go to the north to Siberia. "There is the place for thee, and not here." The monk, overwhelmed with sorrow, went to the ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, and besought him to release him from his obedience. But the patriarch replied that not only was he unable to release him, There was not, and could not be on earth, a power which could release him, except the elder, who had himself laid that duty upon him. In this way the elders are endowed in certain cases with unbounded and inexplicable authority. That is why in many of our monasteries the institution was at first resisted, almost to persecution. Meantime, the elders immediately began to be highly esteemed among the people. Masses of the ignorant people, as well as men of distinction, flocked, for instance, to the elders of our monastery to confess their doubts, their sins, and their sufferings, and ask for counsel and admonition. Seeing this, the opponents of the elders declared that the sacrament of confession was being arbitrarily and frivolously degraded, though the continual opening of the heart to the elder by the monk or the layman had nothing of the character of the sacrament. In the end, however, the institution of elders has been retained and is becoming established in Russian monasteries. It is true, perhaps, that this instrument which had stood the test of 1,000 years for the moral regeneration of a man from slavery to freedom and to moral perfectibility may be a two-edged weapon, and it may lead some not to humility and complete self-control, but to the most satanic pride, that is, to bondage and not to freedom. The elder Zosima was 65. He came of a family of landowners, had been in the army in early youth, and served in the Caucasus as an officer. He had no doubt impressed Alyosha by some peculiar quality of his soul. Alyosha lived in the cell of the elder, who was very fond of him, and let him wait upon him. It must be noted that Alyosha was bound by no obligation, and could go where he pleased and be absent for whole days. Though he wore the monastic dress, it was voluntarily, not to be different from others. No doubt he liked to do so. Possibly his youthful imagination was deeply stirred by the power and fame of his elder. It was said that so many people had for years past come to confess their sins to Father Zosima, and to entreat him for words of advice and healing, that he had acquired the keenest intuition, and could tell from an unknown face what a newcomer wanted, and what was the suffering on his conscience. He sometimes astounded and almost alarmed his visitors by his knowledge of their secrets before they had spoken a word. Alyosha noticed that many, almost all, went into the elder for the first time with apprehension and uneasiness, but came out with bright and happy faces. Alyosha was particularly struck by the fact that Father Zosima was not at all stern. On the contrary, he was always almost gay. The monks used to say that he was more drawn to those who were more sinful, and the greater the sinner, the more he loved him. There were, no doubt, up to the end of his life, among the monks, some who hated and envied him, but they were few in number, and they were silent, though among them were some of great dignity in the monastery. One, for instance, of the older monks, distinguished for his strict keeping of fasts and vows of silence. But the majority were on Father Zosima's side, and very many of them loved him with all their hearts, warmly and sincerely. Some were almost fanatically devoted to him, and declared, though not quite aloud, that he was a saint, that there could be no doubt of it, and, seeing that his end was near, they anticipated miracles and great glory to the monastery in the immediate future from his relics. Alyosha had unquestioning faith in the miraculous power of the elder, just as he had unquestioning faith in the story of the coffin that flew out of the church. He saw many who came with sick children or relatives, and besought the elder to lay hands on them and to pray over them, return shortly after, some the next day, and falling in tears at the elder's feet, thank him for feeling their sick. Whether they had really been healed, or were simply better in the natural course of the disease, was a question which did not exist for Alyosha, for he fully believed in the spiritual power of his teacher, and rejoiced in his fame, in his glory, as though it were his own triumph. His heart throbbed, and he beamed, as it were, all over, when the elder came out to the gates of the hermitage into the waiting crowd of pilgrims of the humbler class, who had flocked from all parts of Russia on purpose to see the elder and obtain his blessing. They fell down before him, wept, kissed his feet, kissed the earth on which he stood, and wailed, while the women held up their children to him and brought him the sick, possessed with devils. The elder spoke to them, read a brief prayer over them, blessed them, and dismissed them. Of late, he had become so weak through attacks of illness that he was sometimes unable to leave his cell, and the pilgrims waited for him to come out for several days. Alyosha did not wonder why they loved him so, why they fell down before him and wept with emotion merely at seeing his face. Oh, he understood that for the humble soul of the Russian peasant, worn out by grief and toil, and still more by the everlasting injustice and everlasting sin, his own and the world's, it was the greatest need and comfort to find someone or something holy to fall down before and worship. Among us there is sin, injustice, and temptation, but yet somewhere on earth there is someone holy and exalted. He has the truth. He knows the truth. So it is not dead upon the earth. So it will come one day to us too, and rule over all the earth according to the promise. Alyosha knew that this was just how the people felt and even reasoned. He understood it. But that the elder Zosima was the saint and custodian of God's truth, of that he had no more doubt than the weeping peasants and the sick women who held out their children to the elder. The conviction that after his death the elder would bring extraordinary glory to the monastery was even stronger in Alyosha than in anyone there. And of late, a kind of deep flame of inner ecstasy burnt more and more strongly in his heart. He was not at all troubled at this elder's standing as a solitary example before him. No matter. He is holy. He carries in his heart the secret of renewal for all, that power which will, at last, establish truth on the earth. And all men will be holy and love one another, and there will be no more rich nor poor, no exalted nor humbled, but all will be as the children of God, and the true kingdom of Christ will come. That was the dream in Alyosha's heart. The arrival of his two brothers, whom he had not known till then, seemed to make a great impression on Alyosha. He more quickly made friends with his half-brother Dmitri, though he arrived later, than with his own brother Ivan. He was extremely interested in his brother Ivan, but when the latter had been 2 months in the town, though they had met fairly often, they were still not intimate. Alyosha was naturally silent, and he seemed to be expecting something, ashamed about something. While his brother Ivan, though Alyosha noticed at first that he looked long and curiously at him, seemed soon to have left off thinking of him. Alyosha noticed it with some embarrassment. He ascribed his brother's indifference at first to the disparity of their age and education, but he also wondered whether the absence of curiosity and sympathy in Ivan might be due to some other cause entirely unknown to him. He kept fancying that Ivan was absorbed in something, something inward and important, that he was striving towards some goal, perhaps very hard to attain, and that that was why he had no thought for him. Alyosha wondered, too, whether there was not some contempt on the part of the learned atheist for him, a foolish novice. He knew for certain that his brother was an atheist. He could not take offence at this contempt, if it existed. Yet, with an uneasy embarrassment which he did not himself understand, he waited for his brother to come nearer to him. Dmitri used to speak of Ivan with the deepest respect and with a peculiar earnestness. From him, Alyosha learnt all the details of the important affair which had of late formed such a close and remarkable bond between the two elder brothers. Dmitri's enthusiastic references to Ivan were the more striking in Alyosha's eyes, since Dmitri was, compared with Ivan, almost uneducated, and the two brothers were such a contrast in personality and character that it would be difficult to find two men more unlike. It was at this time that the meeting, or rather gathering, of the members of this inharmonious family took place in the cell of the elder, who had had such an extraordinary influence on Alyosha. The pretext for this gathering was a false one. It was at this time the discord between Dmitri and his father seemed at its acutest stage, and their relations had become insufferably strained. Fyodor Pavlovich seems to have been the first to suggest, apparently in joke, that they should all meet in Father Zossima's cell, and that, without appealing to his direct intervention, they might more decently come to an understanding under the conciliating influence of the elder's presence. Dmitri, who had never seen the elder, naturally supposed that his father was trying to intimidate him, but as he secretly blamed himself for his outbursts of temper with his father on several recent occasions, he accepted the challenge. It must be noted that he was not, like Ivan, staying with his father, but living apart at the other end of the town. It happened that Pyotr Alexandrovich Musov, who was staying in the district at the time, caught eagerly at the idea. A liberal of the 40s and 50s, a freethinker and atheist, he may have been led on by boredom or the hope of frivolous diversion. He was suddenly seized with a desire to see the monastery and the holy man. As his lawsuit with the monastery still dragged on, he made it the pretext for seeing the superior, in order to attempt to settle it amicably. A visitor coming with such laudable intentions might be received with more attention and consideration than if he came from simple curiosity. Influences from within the monastery were brought to bear on the elder, who of late had scarcely left his cell, and had been forced by illness to deny even his ordinary visitors. In the end he consented to see them, and the day was fixed. "Who has made me a judge over them?" was all he said, smilingly, to Alyosha. Alyosha was much perturbed when he heard of the proposed visit. Of all the wrangling, quarrelsome party, Dmitri was the only one who could regard the interview seriously. All the others would come from frivolous motives, perhaps insulting to the elder. Alyosha was well aware of that. Ivan and Musov would come from curiosity, perhaps of the coarsest kind, while his father might be contemplating some piece of buffoonery. Though he said nothing, Alyosha thoroughly understood his father. The boy, I repeat, was far from being so simple as everyone thought him. He awaited the day with a heavy heart. No doubt he was always pondering in his mind how the family discord could be ended. But his chief anxiety concerned the elder. He trembled for him, for his glory, and dreaded any affront to him, especially the refined, courteous irony of Musov, and the supercilious half-utterances of the highly educated Ivan. He even wanted to venture on warning the elder, telling him something about them. But on second thought said nothing. He only sent word the day before, through a friend, to his brother Dmitri, that he loved him and expected him to keep his promise. Dmitri wondered, for he could not remember what he had promised, but he answered by letter that he would do his utmost not to let himself be provoked by vileness, but that, although he had a deep respect for the elder and for his brother Ivan, he was convinced that the meeting was either a trap for him or an unworthy farce. "Nevertheless, I would rather bite out my tongue than be lacking in respect to the sainted man whom you reverence so highly," he wrote, in conclusion. Alyosha was not greatly cheered by the letter. Part 1, Book 2. An Unfortunate Gathering. Chapter 1. They Arrive at the Monastery. It was a warm, bright day at the end of August. The interview with the elder had been fixed for 11:30, immediately after late Mass. Our visitors did not take part in the service, but arrived just as it was over. First, an elegant open carriage, drawn by two valuable horses, drove up with Musov and a distant relative of his, a young man of 20, called Pyotr Fomich Kelganov. This young man was preparing to enter the university. Musov, with whom he was staying for the time, was trying to persuade him to go abroad to the University of Zurich or Jena. The young man was still undecided. He was thoughtful and absent-minded. He was nice-looking, strongly built, and rather tall. There was a strange fixity in his gaze at times. Like all very absent-minded people, he would sometimes stare at a person without seeing him. He was silent and rather awkward. But sometimes, when he was alone with anyone, he became talkative and effusive, and would laugh at anything or nothing. But his animation vanished as quickly as it appeared. He was always well, and even elaborately dressed. He had already some independent fortune and expectations of much more. He was a friend of Alyosha's. In an ancient, jolting, but roomy, hired carriage with a pair of old, pinkish-grey horses, a long way behind Miusov's carriage, came Fyodor Pavlovich with his son Ivan. Dmitri was late, though he had been informed of the time the evening before. The visitors left their carriage at the hotel outside the precincts and went to the gates of the monastery on foot. Except Fyodor Pavlovich, none of the party had ever seen the monastery, and Miusov had probably not even been to church for 30 years. He looked about him with curiosity, together with assumed ease. But except the church and the domestic buildings, though these two were ordinary enough, he found nothing of interest in the interior of the monastery. The last of the worshippers were coming out of the church, bareheaded, and crossing themselves. Among the humbler people were a few of higher rank, two or three ladies and a very old general. They were all staying at the hotel. Our visitors were at once surrounded by beggars, but none of them gave them anything, except young Kalganov, who took a 10-kopeck piece out of his purse and, nervous and embarrassed, God knows why, hurriedly gave it to an old woman, saying, "Divide it equally." None of his companions made any remark upon it, so that he had no reason to be embarrassed, but perceiving this, he was even more overcome. It was strange that their arrival did not seem expected, and that they were not received with special honour, though one of them had recently made a donation of 1,000 roubles, while another was a very wealthy and highly cultured landowner, upon whom all in the monastery were in a sense dependent, as a decision of the lawsuit might at any moment put their fishing rights in his hands. Yet no official personage met them. Miusov looked absent-mindedly at the tombstones round the church, and was on the point of saying that the dead buried here must have paid a pretty penny for the rights of lying in this holy place, but refrained. His liberal irony was rapidly changing almost into anger. "Who the devil is there to ask in this imbecile place? We must find out, for time is passing," he observed suddenly, as though speaking to himself. All at once there came up a bald-headed, elderly man with ingratiating little eyes, wearing a full summer overcoat. Lifting his hat, he introduced himself with a honeyed lisp as Maximov, a landowner of Tula. He at once entered into our visitor's difficulty. "Father Sosuma lives in the hermitage apart, 400 paces from the monastery, the other side of the copse." "I know it's the other side of the copse," observed Fyodor Pavlovich, "but we don't remember the way. It's a long time since we've been here. This way, by this gate, and straight across the copse. The copse. Come with me, won't you? I'll show you. I have to go. I'm going myself. This way. This way." They came out of the gate and turned towards the copse. Maximov, a man of 60, ran rather than walked, turning sideways to stare at them all with an incredible degree of nervous curiosity. His eyes looked starting out of his head. "You see, we've come to the elder upon business of our own," observed Miusov severely. "That personage has granted us an audience, so to speak, and so, though we thank you for showing us the way, we cannot ask you to accompany us." "I've been there. I've been already. Un chevalier parfait." And Maximov snapped his fingers in the air. "Who is a chevalier?" asked Miusov. "The elder, the splendid elder, the elder, the honour and glory of the monastery, Zosima, such an elder." But his incoherent talk was cut short by a very pale, wan-looking monk of medium height, wearing a monk's cap, who overtook them. Fyodor Pavlovich and Miusov stopped. The monk, with an extremely courteous, profound bow, announced, "The Father Superior invites all of you gentlemen to dine with him after your visit to the hermitage, at 1 o'clock, not later, and you also," he added, addressing Maximov. "That I certainly will, without fail," cried Fyodor Pavlovich, hugely delighted at the invitation. "Believe me, we've all given our word to behave properly here, And you, Pyotr Alexandrovich, will you go to... Yes, of course. What have I come for but to study all the customs here? The only obstacle to me is your company. Yes, Dmitri Fyodorovich is non-existent as yet. It would be a capital thing if he didn't turn up. Do you suppose I like all this business? And in your company, too? So we will come to dinner, thank the Father Superior, he said to the monk. No, it is my duty now to conduct you to the elder, answered the monk. If so, I'll go straight to the Father Superior, to the Father Superior, babbled Maximov. Father Superior is engaged just now. But, as you please, the monk hesitated. Impertinent old man, Musov observed aloud, while Maximov ran back to the monastery. He's like von Sohn, Fyodor Pavlovich said suddenly. Is that all you can think of? In what way is he like von Sohn? Have you ever seen von Sohn? I've seen his portrait. It's not the features, it's something indefinable. He's a second von Sohn. I can always tell from the physiognomy. I dare say you're a connoisseur in that. But look here, Fyodor Pavlovich, you said just now that we'd given our word to behave properly. Remember it. I advise you to control yourself. But if you begin to play the fool, I don't intend to be associated with you here. You see what a man he is, he turned to the monk. I'm afraid to go among decent people with him. A fine smile, not without a certain slyness, came onto the pale, bloodless lips of the monk. But he made no reply, and was evidently silent from a sense of his own dignity. Musov frowned more than ever. Oh, devil, take them all! An outer show elaborated through centuries and nothing but charlatanism and nonsense underneath, flashed through Miosov's mind. There's the hermitage, we've arrived, cried Fyodor Pavlovich. The gates are shut. And he repeatedly made the sign of the cross to the saints painted above and on the sides of the gates. When you go to Rome, you must do as the Romans do. Here in this hermitage are 25 saints being saved. They look at one another and eat cabbages. And not one woman goes in at this gate. That is what is remarkable. And that really is so. But I did hear that the elder receives ladies, he remarked suddenly to the monk. Women of the people are here too now, lying in the portico there waiting. But for ladies of higher rank, two rooms have been built adjoining the portico. But outside the precincts, you can see the windows, and the elder goes out to them by an inner passage when he's well enough. They're always outside the precincts. There's a Harkov lady, Madame Holakov, waiting there now with her sick daughter. Probably he's promised to come out to her, though of late he has been so weak that he has hardly shown himself even to the people. So then there are loopholes, after all, to creep out of the hermitage to the ladies. I don't suppose, Holy Father, that I mean any harm, but do you know that at Athos not only the visits of women are not allowed, but no creature of the female sex, no hens, nor turkey hens, nor cows? Fyodor Pavlovich, I warn you, I shall go back and leave you here. They'll turn you out when I'm gone. But I'm not interfering with you, Pyotr Alexandrovich. Look, he cried suddenly, stepping within the precincts. What a vale of roses they live in! Though there were no roses now, there were numbers of rare and beautiful autumn flowers, growing wherever there was space for them, and evidently tended by a skilful hand. There were flower beds round the church and between the tombs, and the one-storied wooden house where the elder lived was also surrounded with flowers. And it was like this in the time of the last elder, Varsanofi. He didn't care for such elegance. They say he used to jump up and thrash even ladies with a stick, observed Fyodor Pavlovich as he went up the steps. The elder Varsanofi did sometimes seem rather strange, but a great deal that's told is foolishness. He never thrashed anyone, answered the monk. Now, gentlemen, if you will wait a minute, I will announce you. Fyodor Pavlovich, for the last time, you're compact, do you hear? Behave properly or I'll pay you out. Musov had time to mutter again. I can't think why you're so agitated, Fyodor Pavlovich observed sarcastically. Are you uneasy about your sins? They say you can tell by one's eyes what one has come about. And what a lot you think of their opinion, you, a Parisian, and so advanced. I'm surprised at you. But Miusov had no time to reply to this sarcasm. They were asked to come in. He walked in, somewhat irritated. Now, I know myself. I'm annoyed, I shall lose my temper and begin to quarrel, and lower myself and my ideas," he reflected. Chapter 2 The Old Buffoon. They entered the room almost at the same moment that the elder came in from his bedroom. There were already in the cell, awaiting the elder, two monks of the hermitage, one the father librarian, and the other Father Paisi, a very learned man, so they said, in delicate health, though not old. There was also a tall young man who looked about 22, standing in the corner throughout the interview. He had a broad, fresh face, and clever, observant, narrow brown eyes, and was wearing ordinary dress. He was a divinity student, living under the protection of the monastery. His expression was one of unquestioning, but self-respecting, reverence. Being in a subordinate and dependent position, and so not on an equality with the guests, he did not greet them with a bow. Father Zosima was accompanied by a novice, and by Alyosha. The two monks rose and greeted him with a very deep bow, touching the ground with their fingers, then kissed his hand. Blessing them, the elder replied with as deep a reverence to them, and asked their blessing. The whole ceremony was performed very seriously, and with an appearance of feeling, not like an everyday rite. But Miusov fancied that it was all done with intentional impressiveness. He stood in front of the other visitors. He ought, he had reflected upon it the evening before, from simple politeness, since it was the custom here, to have gone up to receive the elder's blessing, even if he did not kiss his hand. But when he saw all this bowing and kissing on the part of the monks, he instantly changed his mind. With dignified gravity he made a rather deep, conventional bow, and moved away to a chair. Fyodor Pavlovich did the same, mimicking Miusov like an ape. Ivan bowed with great dignity and courtesy, but he, too, kept his hands at his sides, while Kalganov was so confused that he did not bow at all. The elder let fall the hand raised to bless them, and bowing to them again, asked them all to sit down. The blood rushed to Alyosha's cheeks. He was ashamed. His forebodings were coming true. Father Zosima sat down on a very old-fashioned mahogany sofa, covered with leather, and made his visitors sit down in a row along the opposite wall on four mahogany chairs, covered with shabby black leather. The monks sat, one at the door and the other at the window. The divinity student, the novice, and Alyosha remained standing. The cell was not very large, and had a faded look. It contained nothing but the most necessary furniture of coarse and poor quality. There were two pots of flowers in the window and a number of holy pictures in the corner. Before one huge ancient icon of the Virgin, a lamp was burning. Near it were two other holy pictures in shining settings, and next them carved cherubims, china eggs, a Catholic cross of ivory, with a Mater Dolorosa embracing it, and several foreign engravings from the great Italian artists of past centuries. Next to these costly and artistic engravings were several of the roughest Russian prints of saints and martyrs, such as are sold for a few farthings at all the fairs. On the other walls were portraits of Russian bishops, past and present. Miusov took a cursory glance at all these conventional surroundings and bent an intent look upon the elder. He had a high opinion of his own insight, a weakness excusable in him as he was 50, an age in which a clever man of the world of established position can hardly help taking himself rather seriously. At the first moment he did not like Zosima. There was indeed something in the elder's face which many people besides Miusov might not have liked. He was a short, bent little man with very weak legs, and though he was only 65, he looked at least 10 years older. His face was very thin and covered with a network of fine wrinkles, particularly numerous about his eyes, which were small, light-coloured, quick, and shining like two bright points. He had a sprinkling of grey hair about his temples. His pointed beard was small and scanty, and his lips, which smiled frequently, were as thin as two threads. His nose was not long, but sharp, like a bird's beak. To all appearances, a malicious soul full of petty pride, thought Miusov. He felt altogether dissatisfied with his position. A cheap little clock on the wall struck 12 hurriedly and served to begin the conversation.
"Precisely to our time," cried Fyodor Pavlovich. "But no sign of my son Dmitri. I apologize for him, sacred elder."
Alyosha shuddered all over at sacred elder.
"I'm always punctual myself, minute for minute, remembering that punctuality is the courtesy of kings."
"But you are not a king anywhere," Miusov muttered, losing his self-restraint at once.
"Yes, that's true. I'm not a king. And would you believe it, Pyotr Alexandrovich, I was aware of that myself. But there, I always say the wrong thing. Your reverence," he cried with sudden pathos, "you behold before you a buffoon in earnest. I introduce myself as such. It's an old habit, alas. And if I sometimes talk nonsense out of place, it's with an object, with the object of amusing people and making myself agreeable. One must be agreeable, mustn't one? I was 7 years ago in a little town where I had business, and I made friends with some merchants there. We went to the captain of police because we had to see him about something and to ask him to dine with us. He was a tall, fat, fair, sulky man, the most dangerous type in such cases. It's their liver. I went straight up to him with the ease of a man of the world, you know. 'Mr. Ispravnik,' said I, 'be our Napravnik.' 'What do you mean by Napravnik?' said he. I saw at the first half-second that it had missed fire. He stood there so glum. 'I wanted to make a joke,' said I, 'for the general diversion, and as Mr. Napravnik is our well-known Russian orchestra conductor, and what we need for the harmony of our undertaking is someone of that sort.' And I explained my comparison very reasonably, didn't I? 'Excuse me,' said he, 'I am an Ispravnik, and I do not allow puns to be made on my calling.' He turned and walked away. I followed him, shouting, 'Yes, yes, you are an Ispravnik, not a Napravnik.' 'No,' he said, 'since you call me a Napravnik, I am one.' And would you believe it, ruined our business. And I'm always like that, always like that, always injuring myself with my politeness. Once, many years ago, I said to an influential person, 'Your wife is a ticklish lady,' in an honourable sense, of the moral quality, so to speak. But he asked me, 'Why have you tickled her?' I thought I'd be polite, so I couldn't help saying yes, and he gave me a fine tickling on the spot. Only that happened long ago, so I'm not ashamed to tell the story. I'm always injuring myself like that.'
'You're doing it now,' muttered Miusov with disgust. Father Zosima scrutinized them both in silence.
'Am I? Would you believe it, I was aware of that too, Pyotr Alexandrovich. And let me tell you, indeed, I foresaw I should as soon as I began to speak. And do you know I foresaw, too, that you'd be the first to remark on it? The minute I see my joke isn't coming off, your reverence, both my cheeks feel as though they were drawn down to the lower jaw, and there's almost a spasm in them. That's been so since I was young, when I had to make jokes for my living in noblemen's families. I am an inveterate buffoon, and have been from my birth up, your reverence. It's as though it were a craze in me. I dare say it's a devil within me, but only a little one. A more serious one would have chosen another lodging. But not your soul, Pyotr Alexandrovich. You're not a lodging worth having either. But I do believe, I believe in God, though I have had doubts of late, but now I sit and await words of wisdom. I'm like the philosopher Diderot, your reverence. Did you ever hear, most holy father, how Diderot went to see the metropolitan Platon in time of the Empress Catherine? He went in and said straight out, 'There is no God.' To which the great bishop lifted up his finger and answered, 'The fool has said in his heart, there is no God.' And he fell down at his feet on the spot. 'I believe,' he cried, 'and will be christened.' And so he was. Princess Dashkov was his godmother, and Potyomkin his godfather.
Fyodor Pavlovich, this is unbearable. You know you're telling lies, and that stupid anecdote isn't true. Why are you playing the fool?' cried Miusov in a shaking voice.
I suspected all my life that it wasn't true,
Fyodor Pavlovich cried with great conviction.
But I'll tell you the whole truth, gentlemen. Great elder, forgive me, the last thing about Diderot's christening I made up just now. I never thought of it before. I made it up to add piquancy. I play the fool Pyotr Alexandrovich to make myself agreeable. I really don't know myself sometimes what I do it for. And as for Diderot, I heard as far as the fool hath said in his heart 20 times from the gentry about here when I was young. I heard your aunt, Pyotr Alexandrovich, tell the story. They all believe to this day that the infidel Diderot came to dispute about God with the metropolitan Platon.
So Mitya began and broke down at the first sentence. We will not reproduce his speech word for word, but will only summarize the gist of it. 3 months ago he said he had of express intention. Mitya purposely used these words instead of intentionally. Consulted a lawyer in the chief town of the province.
A distinguished lawyer, Kuzma Kuzmich Pavel Pavlovich Korneplodov. You have perhaps heard of him, a man of vast intellect, the mind of a statesman. He knows you too, spoke of you in the highest terms.
Mitya broke down again, but these breaks did not deter him. He leapt instantly over the gaps and struggled on and on. This Korneplodov, after questioning him minutely and inspecting the documents he was able to bring, Mitya alluded somewhat vaguely to these documents and slurred over the subject with special haste. Reported that they certainly might take proceedings concerning the village of Chermashnya, which ought, he said, to have come to him, Mitya, from his mother, and so checkmate the old villain his father, because every door was not closed and justice might still find a loophole. In fact, he might reckon on an additional sum of 6 or even 7,000 rubles from Fyodor Pavlovich, as Chermashnya was worth at least 25,000. He might say 28,000, in fact.
30, 30, Kuzma Kuzmich, and would you believe it, I didn't get 17 from that heartless man.
So he, Mitya, had thrown the business up for the time, knowing nothing about the law, but on coming here was struck dumb by a cross-claim made upon him. Here Mitya went adrift again and again took a flying leap forward.
So will not you, excellent and honoured Kuzma Kuzmich, be willing to take up all my claims against that unnatural monster and pay me a sum down of only 3,000? You see, you cannot in any case lose over it. On my honour, I swear that. Quite the contrary, you may make 6 or 7,000 instead of 3.
Above all, he wanted this concluded that very day.
I'll do the business with you at a notary's, or whatever it is. In fact, I'm ready to do anything. I'll hand over all the deeds, whatever you want, sign anything, and we could draw up the agreement at once. And if it were possible, if it were only possible that very morning, you could pay me that 3,000, for there isn't a capitalist in this town to compare with you, and so would save me from, for a good, I might say an honourable action. For I cherish the most honourable feelings for a certain person whom you know well and care for as a father. I would not have come, indeed, if it had not been as a father. And indeed, it's a struggle of three in this business for its fate. That's a fearful thing, Kuzma Kuzmich. A tragedy, Kuzma Kuzmich, a tragedy. And as you've dropped out long ago, it's a tug of war between two. I'm expressing it awkwardly, perhaps, but I'm not a literary man. You see, I'm on the one side, and the monster on the other. So you must choose. It's either I or the monster. It all lies in your hands, the fate of three lives and the happiness of two. Excuse me, I'm making a mess of it, but you understand. I see from your venerable eyes that you understand. And if you don't understand, I am done for. So you see.
Mitya broke off his clumsy speech with that, so you see, and jumping up from his seat awaited the answer to his foolish proposal. At the last phrase he had suddenly become hopelessly aware that it had all fallen flat, above all that he had been talking utter nonsense.
How strange it is, on the way here it seemed all right, and now it's nothing but nonsense.
The idea suddenly dawned on his despairing mind. All the while he'd been talking, the old man sat motionless, watching him with an icy expression in his eyes. After keeping him for a moment in suspense, Kuzma Kuzmich pronounced at last in the most positive and chilling tone,
"Excuse me, we don't undertake such business."
Mitya suddenly felt his legs growing weak under him.
"What am I to do now, Kuzma Kuzmich?" he muttered with a pale smile. "I suppose it's all up with me. What do you think?"
"Excuse me."
Mitya remained standing, staring, motionless. He suddenly noticed a movement in the old man's face. He started.
"You see, sir, business of that sort's not in our line," said the old man slowly. "There's the court and the lawyers. It's a perfect misery. But if you like, there is a man here you might apply to."
"Good heavens, who is it? You're my salvation, Kuzma Kuzmich," faltered Mitya.
"He doesn't live here, and he's not here just now. He is a peasant. He does business in timber. His name is Lyagavy. He's been haggling with Fyodor Pavlovich for the last year over your copse at Chermashnya. They can't agree on the price, maybe you've heard. Now he's come back again and is staying with the priest at Ilyinskoye, about 12 versts from the Volovia station. He wrote to me, too, about the business of the copse, asking my advice. Fyodor Pavlovich means to go and see him himself. So if you were to be beforehand with Fyodor Pavlovich and to make Lyagavy the offer you've made me, he might possibly—"
"A brilliant idea,"
Mitya interrupted ecstatically.
"He's the very man. It would just suit him. He's haggling with him for it, being asked too much. And here he would have all the documents entitling him to the property itself. Ha, ha!"
And Mitya suddenly went off into his short wooden laugh, startling Samsonov.
"How can I thank you, Kuzma Kuzmich?"
cried Mitya effusively.
"Don't mention it,"
said Samsonov, inclining his head.
"But you don't know. You've saved me. Oh, it was a true presentiment brought me to you. So now, to this priest."
"No need of thanks.
I'll make haste and fly there. I'm afraid I've overtaxed your strength. I shall never forget it. It's a Russian says that, Kuzma Kuzmich. A Russian."
"To be sure."
Mitya seized his hand to press it, but there was a malignant gleam in the old man's eye. Mitya drew back his hand, but at once blamed himself for his mistrustfulness.
"It's because he's tired," he thought. For her sake, Kuzma Kuzmich. You understand that it's for her,"
he cried, his voice ringing through the room. He bowed, turned sharply round, and with the same long stride walked to the door without looking back. He was trembling with delight.
"Everything was on the verge of ruin, and my guardian angel saved me,"
was the thought in his mind. And if such a businessman as Samsonov, a most worthy old man and what dignity, had suggested this course, then success was assured. He would fly off immediately.
"I'll be back before night. I shall be back at night, and the thing is done. Could the old man have been laughing at me?"
exclaimed Mitya as he strode towards his lodging. He could, of course, imagine nothing but that the advice was practical from such a businessman, with an understanding of the business, with an understanding of this Lyagavy, curious surname, or the old man was laughing at him. Alas, the second alternative was the correct one. Long afterwards, when the catastrophe had happened, old Samsonov himself confessed, laughing, that he'd made a fool of the captain. He was a cold, spiteful, and sarcastic man, liable to violent antipathies. Whether it was the captain's excited face, or the foolish conviction of the rake and spendthrift, that he, Samsonov, could be taken in by such a cock-and-bull story as his scheme, or jealousy over Grushenka, in whose name this scapegrace had rushed in on him with such a tale to get money. Which worked on the old man, I can't tell. But at the instant when Mitya stood before him, feeling his legs grow weak under him, and frantically exclaiming that he was ruined, at that moment the old man looked at him with intense spite, and resolved to make a laughing stock of him. When Mitya had gone, Kuzma Kuzmich, white with rage, turned to his son and bade him see to it that that beggar be never seen again, and never admitted even into the yard, or else he'd— He did not utter his threat, but even his son, who often saw him enraged, trembled with fear. For a whole hour afterwards the old man was shaking with anger, and by evening he was worse, and sent for the doctor. Chapter 2. Lyagavy. So, he must drive at full speed, and he had not the money for horses. He had 40 kopecks, and that was all that was left after so many years of prosperity.
but he had at home an old silver watch which had long ceased to go. He snatched it up and carried it to a Jewish watchmaker who had a shop in the marketplace. The Jew gave him 6 rubles for it. "And I didn't expect that!" cried Mitya ecstatically. He was still in a state of ecstasy. He seized his 6 rubles and ran home. At home he borrowed 3 rubles from the people of the house, who loved him so much that they were pleased to give it him, though it was all they had. Mitya, in his excitement, told them on the spot that his fate would be decided that day, and he described in desperate haste the whole scheme he had put before Samsonov, the latter's decision, his own hopes for the future, and so on. These people had been told many of their lodger's secrets before, and so looked upon him as a gentleman who was not at all proud, and almost one of themselves. Having thus collected 9 rubles, Mitya sent for posting horses to take him to the Volovya station. This was how the fact came to be remembered, and established that, at midday on the day before the event, Mitya had not a farthing, and that he had sold his watch to get money and had borrowed 3 rubles from his landlords, all in the presence of witnesses. I note this fact. Later on it will be apparent why I do so. Though he was radiant with the joyful anticipation that he would at last solve all his difficulties, yet, as he drew near Volovya station, he trembled at the thought of what Grushenka might be doing in his absence. What if she made up her mind today to go to Fyodor Pavlovitch? This was why he'd gone off without telling her, and why he left orders with his landlady not to let out where he'd gone, if anyone came to inquire for him. I must get back tonight, he repeated, as he was jolted along the cart, and I dare say I shall have to bring this Lyagavy back here to draw up the deed. So mused Mitya with a throbbing heart. But alas, his dreams were not fated to be carried out. To begin with, he was late, taking a short cut from Volovya station, which turned out to be 18 versts instead of 12. Secondly, he did not find the priest at home at Ilyinskoye. He'd gone off to a neighbouring village. While Mitya, setting off there with the same exhausted horses, was looking for him, it was almost dark. The priest, a shy and amiable-looking little man, informed him at once that, though Lyagavy had been staying with him at first, he was now at Suhoy Posyolok, that he was staying the night in the forester's cottage as he was buying timber there, too. At Mitya's urgent request that he would take him to Lyagavy at once, and by so doing, save him, so to speak, the priest agreed, after some demur, to conduct him to Sukhoi Posyolok. His curiosity was obviously aroused, but unluckily advised their going on foot, as it would not be much over a verst. Mitya, of course, agreed, and marched off with his yard-long strides, so that the poor priest almost ran after him. He was a very cautious man, though not old. Mitya at once began talking to him, too, of his plans, nervously and excitedly asking advice in regard to Lyagavy, and talking all the way. He turned off Mitya's questions with, "I don't know, I can't say, how can I tell?" and so on. When Mitya began to speak of his quarrel with his father over his inheritance, the priest was positively alarmed, as he was in some way dependent on Fyodor Pavlovitch. He inquired, however, with surprise, why he called the peasant trader Gorstkin, Lyagavy, and obligingly explained to Mitya that though the man's name really was Lyagavy, he was never called so, as he would be grievously offended at the name, and that he must be sure to call him Gorstkin. "Or you'll do nothing with him, he won't even listen to you," said the priest in conclusion. Mitya was somewhat surprised for a moment, and explained that that was what Samsonov had called him. On hearing this fact, the priest dropped the subject, though he would have done well to put into words his doubt whether, if Samsonov had sent him to that peasant, calling him Lyagavy, there was not something wrong about it, and he was turning him into ridicule. But Mitya had no time to pause over such trifles. He hurried, striding along, and only when he reached Suhoy Posyolok he realized that they had come not 1 verst, nor 1.5, but at least 3. This annoyed him, but he controlled himself. They went into the hut. The forester lived in 1 half of the hut, and Gorstkin was lodging in the other, the better room the other side of the passage. They went into that room and lighted a tallow candle. The hut was extremely overheated.
On the table there was a samovar that had gone out, a tray with cups, an empty rum bottle, a bottle of vodka partly full, and some half-eaten crusts of wheaten bread. The visitor himself lay stretched at full length on the bench, with his coat crushed up under his head for a pillow, snoring heavily. Mitya stood in perplexity. "Of course I must wake him. My business is too important. I've come in such haste. I'm in a hurry to get back today," he said in great agitation. But the priest and the forester stood in silence, not giving their opinion. Mitya went up and began trying to wake him himself. He tried vigorously, but the sleeper did not wake. "He's drunk," Mitya decided. "Good Lord, what am I to do? What am I to do?" And terribly impatient, he began pulling him by the arms, by the legs, shaking his head, lifting him up and making him sit on the bench. Yet, after prolonged exertions, he could only succeed in getting the drunken man to utter absurd grunts and violent but inarticulate oaths. "No, you'd better wait a little," the priest pronounced at last, "for he's obviously not in a fit state." "He's been drinking the whole day," the forester chimed in. "Good heavens!" cried Mitya. "If only you knew how important it is to me and how desperate I am." "No, you'd better wait till morning," the priest repeated. "Till morning? Mercy, that's impossible." And in his despair he was on the point of attacking the sleeping man again, but stopped short at once, realizing the uselessness of his efforts. The priest said nothing. The sleepy forester looked gloomy. "What terrible tragedies real life contrives for people," said Mitya in complete despair. The perspiration was streaming down his face. The priest seized the moment to put before him, very reasonably, that even if he succeeded in wakening the man, he would still be drunk and incapable of conversation. "And your business is important," he said, "so you'd certainly better put it off till morning." With a gesture of despair, Mitya agreed. "Father, I will stay here with the light and seize the favorable moment. As soon as he wakes, I'll begin. I'll pay you for the light," he said to the forester. "For the night's lodging, too. You'll remember Dmitri Karamazov. Only, Father, I don't know what we're to do with you. Where will you sleep?" "No, I'm going home. I'll take his horse and get home," he said, indicating the forester. "And now I'll say goodbye. I wish you all success." So it was settled. The priest rode off on the forester's horse, delighted to escape, though he shook his head uneasily, wondering whether he ought not next day to inform his benefactor Fyodor Pavlovich of this curious incident, or he may, in an unlucky hour, hear of it, be angry, and withdraw his favour. The forester, scratching himself, went back to his room without a word, and Mitya sat on the bench to catch the favourable moment, as he expressed it. Profound dejection clung about his soul like a heavy mist, a profound, intense dejection. He sat thinking, but could reach no conclusion. The candle burnt dimly, a cricket chirped. It became insufferably close in the overheated room. He suddenly pictured the garden, the path behind the garden, the door of his father's house mysteriously opening, and Grushenka running in. He leapt up from the bench. "It's a tragedy," he said, grinding his teeth. Mechanically he went up to the sleeping man and looked in his face. He was a lean, middle-aged peasant with a very long face, flaxen curls, and a long, thin, reddish beard, wearing a blue cotton shirt and a black waistcoat, from the pocket of which peeped the chain of a silver watch. Mitya looked at his face with intense hatred, and for some unknown reason his curly hair particularly irritated him. What was insufferably humiliating was that, after leaving things of such importance and making such sacrifices, he, Mitya, utterly worn out, should, with business of such urgency, be standing over this dolt on whom his whole fate depended, while he snored as though there were nothing the matter, as though he'd dropped from another planet. "Oh, the irony of fate!" cried Mitya, and quite losing his head, he fell again to rousing the tipsy peasant. He roused him with a sort of ferocity, pulled him, pushed him, even beat him. But after 5 minutes of vain exertions, he returned to his bench in helpless despair and sat down. "Stupid! Stupid!" cried Mitya. "And how dishonorable it all is!" Something made him mad. His head began to ache horribly. Should he fling it up and go away altogether? He wondered. "No, wait till tomorrow now. I'll stay on purpose. What else did I come for? Besides, I've no means of going.
How am I to get away from here now? Oh, the idiocy of it.
But his head ached more and more. He sat without moving and unconsciously dozed off and fell asleep as he sat. He seemed to have slept 2 hours or more. He was waked up by his head aching so unbearably that he could have screamed. There was a hammering in his temples and the top of his head